Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Finding the right cell phone and cell phone plan can be overwhelming, what with all the different carriers, deals, and devices. The upside to this confusion? It is helping lower the costs to consumers. Joining us now to discuss the mobile carrier price wars is New York Times tech writer Farhad Manju. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
You trace the source of this price war to the government's blocking of a merger between AT&T and then-struggling T-Mobile in 2011. What would have happened if the merger had gone through?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that the government worried about back then was that, we have four major carriers in the United States, T-Mobile, Verizon, Sprint, and AT&T. And so AT&T was going to buy T-Mobile, and the government said, after sort of long study, both the FCC and Department of Justice said that they thought that reducing the four major carriers to three major carriers would, obviously reduce competition and either raise prices or keep prices stagnant and not help lower prices for consumers. But they saw, what was interesting about it was that they saw that in AT&T's purchase offer to T-Mobile, AT&T had made a promise that if the deal didn't go through, a larger company, AT&T, would have to pay the smaller company, T-Mobile, about $3 billion. And the government, regulators saw that if they actually got that $3 billion, T-Mobile could rebuild its network, and that may actually make it a viable competitor with, the larger carriers.
Is that that $3 billion offer, is that pretty typical in those kinds of big mergers?
Yeah, I mean, it's called a breakup fee.
Okay.
And it indicates the confidence that AT&T had at the time that the deal would go through.
So what did T-Mobile do with the $3 billion that changes what they're able to offer us in the marketplace?
Yeah, the big thing in the market today, in the market for cell phone, is data. The part of your bill that is used for surfing the web. And what people especially wanted around that time, what was becoming big, was these new data networks called LTE networks. And basically, those are the fastest kind of cellular smartphone data networks. They let you get the web faster. They let you just sort of do everything with your phone more quickly. And at the time, T-Mobile didn't have much LTE coverage. So the money and the other part of it that was that AT&T had to give to T-Mobile was some radio spectrum rights. So both those things helped T-Mobile build out its network and kind of expand its coverage. So now T-Mobile, in various big cities, its coverage area is not as large as AT&T and Verizon, but it's sort of in striking distance. If you live in one of the bigger cities, even a medium-sized city in the United States, you can get fairly good T-Mobile coverage in those areas, which was not something that was possible really before the breakup of this merger.
So how has that changed how other carriers like AT&T, Verizon, and Sprint have, how has it changed how they're doing business?
Yeah, well, the first thing that happened was that kind of after the breakup of the merger, T-Mobile's parent company, which is a German company, they appointed this guy, John Legere, as the CEO, and he's really sort of shaken things up in the industry. He lowered prices at T-Mobile. He removed contracts. So, we've always known that when you buy cell phones, you buy them on this two-year contract plan. T-Mobile eliminated those, and what was most important was that it eliminated kind of the connection between your smartphone as a device and the plan you were on. So now you can buy the plan alone and you pay a separate fee for the smartphone. And what this enables you to do is, pay for your phone over time. And then once you're done paying for your phone, your bill goes down. On other carriers, under the two-year contract plan, even after you paid for the portion of your bill that might have covered your smartphone, you still sort of kept paying the same amount, even if the carrier had recouped the cost of giving you, you know, an iPhone or Android phone.
This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Farhad Manjoo. He's a tech writer for The New York Times. Have consumers actually been switching to T-Mobile, or are they taking advantage of the deals their own carriers have been offering in response to T-Mobile? What changes have we seen on that level?
I mean, both things have been happening. So T-Mobile in the last year and a half gained about 4 million, more than 4 million customers, which is a big turnaround for the carrier. In the past, it had been losing customers. The other thing that's happened is that because the customers have been fleeing rival services, the rival services have had to change their plans, especially AT&T has adopted similar no-contract pricing, has lowered its prices, and sort of added various services that T-Mobile gave to users. So, you know, it's worked out for people who decided to switch and for people who decided not to switch because, you know, just as the government had predicted, this competition, you know, keeping T-Mobile alive in the marketplace forced kind of the rest of the carriers to compete and, you know, led to low prices all around.
Some say that T-Mobile can't afford to sustain the prices they're offering now, the deals they're offering now, that it's because of that $3 billion infusion. Has that $4 million increase in their customer base given them more hope for the future?
This is the part that's unclear at the moment. I mean, they're spending a lot on these promotions. They reported a loss in their quarterly revenues a couple weeks ago. And, you know, so one of their latest promotions, for example, they're offering to pay their customers early termination fees with other carriers. So, you know, if I have AT&T and I want to switch out to T-Mobile, if I'm still under contract with AT&T, I might owe them a couple hundred dollars or more. T-Mobile is offering to pay that fee for new customers. You know, those kinds of promotions cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And the worry is that, well, I mean, sort of the criticism of T-Mobile is that it can't afford to do that forever. And you know, its rivals say that in the long run, T-Mobile's network quality will suffer because it won't have, you know, it won't have enough money to kind of maintain that network, especially to expand the network. This is, you know, I think it's a plausible argument, but it's not, it doesn't seem to be, you know, affecting coverage right now. And the other thing about T-Mobile is that because it has no contracts, is people switch, and then they find out later on that, you know, that the network quality isn't very good, if we just switch to something else.
Mm-hmm. So how long, some have said that T-Mobile is trying to add that customer base so that they can eventually sell to Sprint, another possible contraction in the marketplace. What do you think the likelihood is of that?
Yeah, I mean, this is the, you know, everyone suspects that this is kind of T-Mobile's long-term move because, you know, at the rate it's going, it is not making very much money. It's sort of created this difficulty for itself, though, which is that, you know, it's proven to regulators that there's value in having these four carriers competing with one another. There's value for consumers in that. So regulators have been very skeptical of this idea that the two smaller carriers, Sprint and T-Mobile, might merge together because that would, you know, once again, reduce the number of carriers available to customers. And they fear it would reduce this sort of competitive drive. We'll see what happens. They think that, you know, it seems like Sprint and T-Mobile might push ahead with this at some point, but the regulators have been very wary of approving anything like this.
What are the phone makers? Do they have any interest or any stake in this?
They do. Yeah, this is sort of the even longer range effect. I mean, one of the reasons that Apple and Samsung do so well is because the cost of their devices has long been sort of essentially hidden from customers. You know, you pay $200 for a new iPhone when you sign up to a carrier with a 2-year contract, but that phone actually costs, you know, Apple actually gets about $650 for that phone. AT&T kind of hides the cost from consumers, which is good for Apple, and you pay over the long run. And, you know, every 2 years, Apple and other telephone manufacturers are kind of guaranteed that you're going to upgrade to the new thing, because if you don't, under your 2-year contract, you're just kind of paying for nothing. You're getting a free upgrade, but you're not exercising that. So you're paying even though your device has already been paid off. Mm-hmm. So for Apple, that's great. You know, it forces people to kind of be on this 2-year upgrade cycle. With T-Mobile's plan, what you do is you pay for your device, and then once you're done paying for it, your bill goes down. And some people might realize, well, you know, my bill has gone down. My 2-year-old phone is perfectly good. I don't need to buy a new one anymore. I can make it last for 3 years or 4 years. And if that's the case, you know, the sort of the upgrade times for Apple and other manufacturers, you know, they get slowed down, and that might be bad for their bottom line.
Can the rest of us, I mean, maybe we haven't upgraded, can we go, should we go to our provider and ask them if they can lower the price of our monthly bill?
Yeah, I would really recommend that. I mean, one of the things that I noticed while writing the story is that, you know, personally, I could be saving money if I moved to another carrier. And I think that many, many people will notice that. I mean, there's been tremendous experimentation in pricing and lots of promotions over the past year. I mean, people who watch this market say there's basically a price war going on between the carriers. The pricing can be a little complicated, especially if you have a family plan and you have many lines that you might have very complicated needs. So the pricing can be somewhat difficult. You might need to spend half an hour or more kind of looking up the 4 carriers and deciding what will actually save you money. But I think that it might be worth it. You might, you know, realize you can save $50 or more a month by doing so.
All right. Well, Farhad Manju, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
Farhad Manju, he is a tech writer for the New York Times. Tech Tuesday will continue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. This is Ann Fisher. A job search used to be pretty complicated. You would spend your Sunday with the newspaper in the want ad section, trolling for the jobs that fit your description, and then call your friends, call former work associates, something like that. Now LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook and dozens of mobile apps play a role in the job hunt. But you have to know how to use them. Joining us now is the author of Job Searching with Social Media for Dummies, now in a second edition, Joshua Waldman. Welcome back to the show, or welcome to the show, Joshua, I should say.
Hi, Ann. How's it going?
Fine, thanks. So just how much have things changed in the past 5 years for both employers and job seekers? I know, really, the whole want ad section in the newspaper's been long gone.
Yeah, that was the first phase out with online job boards. But even in the last 5 years, I think, wow, if you haven't been looking for a job and you suddenly are back in the job market after 5 years, it's going to be culture shock. It really is very, very different now.
What's been the biggest change?
Well, I think when the recession hit, one of the biggest changes was that companies started to rely more and more on employee referrals. And free tools like LinkedIn and Facebook and Twitter in order to get those referrals. And they're paying less and less money for job boards listings, which are still very expensive. And so it became much more about, it's funny, it's sort of like the way things were 50 years ago when it was who you knew that's going to help you get get that great job.
Has social media, talk about LinkedIn a little bit and why you call it free, because I know that I can get into LinkedIn free, but if I want to get extra services, like, you know, I can look at job openings, but if I want to find out how much they're paying, well, that's going to cost me something.
Yeah, and it wasn't always like that, Anne. It was, you know, when they first got started, many years ago, I started using LinkedIn in 2006. You got a lot of those features for free. And, you know, it seems like every year they lock down another feature that you have to pay for. And certainly during the recession in 2008 and 2009, particularly, there was a lot more features that you did not have to pay for on LinkedIn.
Now, would you consider the social media in general has made the job hunt easier or more difficult?
That really depends, right? I think it made it easier because, well, I use social media. I'm not afraid of it. And that happens to be where recruiters hang out. And so it was a very good match. If using technology like this is not something that you're comfortable with, it can be very challenging because those conversations are really happening over these channels. There's a lot of studies. In fact, the JobVite 2014 study just came out, and it showed something like several million more Americans found their job via Facebook than LinkedIn itself. And still we're talking in the 8 to 10 million Americans finding jobs over social media.
Right. I mean, people are using Twitter and Facebook to find jobs. These aren't considered traditionally job searching sites. How would one use Facebook to find a job? How does that work?
It's an interesting question, and there's this total discrepancy. You know, you have recruiters who love LinkedIn. They love LinkedIn. But many more people find jobs over Facebook. So what's going on there? It's a great question. What I think is happening is that referrals are happening. We get referred into job opportunities because friends and family refer us to companies. Well, guess what network has our friends and family on it? It's Facebook. And I think what happens with Facebook is it's not a place for recruiters yet to be trolling. I think it's where conversations are happening and referrals are being made.
How do recruiters use LinkedIn? How do they troll for you?
You know, there's a lot of ways they do that. But I think the most common way a recruiter uses LinkedIn is that they do searches for keywords. Now, what's interesting about that is they may be looking to fill a position. They're going to put that role or job title into their search query. The results are actually going to show up in order of degree of separation. So there's a big argument to be made that the larger your network, the bigger your chances are of actually showing up in a recruiter's search result.
So that's the idea of just link in with everybody you can.
It is, although, you know, there are problems with that as well, because now you have a network of, you know, 50% of them, you won't even know who they are.
Mm-hmm. And they could be detrimental.
I haven't heard of that.
Okay.
You might be asked to make a referral or give a recommendation of someone you don't know, and you have to say no. And mm-hmm. if you're not comfortable saying no, then, you know, that might be difficult.
Not one of my issues, but I can imagine if that is someone's problem. 614-292-8513. If you have a job search question for my guest, that's what we're talking about, is a job search using social media. Joshua Waldman is the author of Job Searching with Social Media for Dummies. It's now in its second edition. What changed between the first and the second edition?
You know, quite a bit. Even things have changed now. It's a very active marketplace. You know, LinkedIn's features have completely shifted. Between the first and second edition, LinkedIn has gone public. Twitter has gone public. Facebook has gone public. And that means a lot of their feature sets have changed. Their user interfaces are getting better and better, easier to use. LinkedIn's revenue from the first edition was something like 20% from their recruiting product. By the second edition, it was over 50% of their revenue was coming from their recruiting product. So their cultural focus has changed as a company, and that has a big implication as a job seeker who's looking to get on the radar.
Now, I read that it's a big deal that you have your photo or some kind of photo of yourself up with LinkedIn, that recruiters don't like it when you just do the, you know, when it's just the, what do you call it, just the outline.
Yeah, the blank, the who is this shadow, silhouette. Yeah. I think you put your finger on the largest difference between a job search today and that which was conducted maybe 10 or 15 years ago, where, you know, it was a very faux pas thing to attach a picture to a resume or a CV back then. But now it's sort of, you know, if you're not putting your picture up there with your profile, you're not even playing the game. There's a sense of distrust and, you know, what is this person hiding? Rather than, you know, what are they looking at? And I know this makes some people cringe, but the reality is that recruiters now want to see your picture. And you know, we're really the only country that has such a boon on sharing our pictures with our job applications.
Oh, really?
Yeah, attaching a picture to a CV is a very common practice in Asia and in Europe.
Oh, I see. Is a taboo here that people still have, are still leery about it here. We're the only country that's still leery about it. We've talked before with many people on this program about how to manage your social media now for that job in the future, that if you don't watch it, you're going to make mistakes now that'll come back to haunt you. What are some of the big mistakes, or what are your recommendations to people about how they manage their social media now to make things better in the future should they ever need a job?
Well, I think there is only one inevitable outcome of having a job, and that is one day you won't have it anymore. You know, we do change our jobs very, very frequently these days. And therefore, it really behooves everybody to be thinking about the future and building that personal brand. And that's really the eye that everyone should have is, you know, what you do now online is really an act of publishing. And what you publish sticks around for a while. And so you can either be building your brand and your message and your body of work, or you can be, you know, taking money out of the bank, so to speak, of using it up.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you have a job search question about how to do that job online, if it's new to you perhaps, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Let's turn to some of the mobile apps that are out there. Tell us about Glassdoor. What does that one do?
You know, I really like Glassdoor. My wife, who is actually thinking about her next job, downloaded Glassdoor and was using it to find out. You know, what's cool about it is it tells you what salaries you can possibly be making. And it's a very transparent platform. So instead of just job listings and, you know, locations, you can actually sort by how much you're going to get paid at those jobs, which, you know, of course, that informs our decisions. It's a very honest approach to using a job board, I think.
And Card Munch, I don't even know if I like the name of that, but what does Card Munch do? That is a LinkedIn product.
Card Munch is a LinkedIn product, and I use it quite a bit. It's not very well known for some reason. Imagine that you're coming back from a networking event, and you have a stack of business cards on your desk, and you're like, oh my gosh, I either have to type them in or give them to my you know, assistant or you know, teenage kid to type them all in. Well, rather than making it a manual process, Card Munch actually uses scanning parsing technology. So you take a picture of the card, and it processes it, and then basically a couple of hours later, it has parsed out the name and email address and phone number and puts it in your contact record.
So that just gets you organized.
It does get you organized. And it also streamlines those contacts into LinkedIn. With one touch, you can invite your new friends into your LinkedIn network.
Then there's Broadly. It tells you how to maximize a large LinkedIn network. First of all, what do you define as a large LinkedIn network?
Well, you're right. It is relative. A lot of people keep their LinkedIn networks kind of small, right? Less than maybe around 250, definitely less than 500. But once you're over 500, it becomes very hard psychologically, I think, to keep track of all those people. And so there's some very cool tools that are starting to emerge. One of them is Broadly, Broadly. It's an app. I believe it's just for iPhone right now. And it looks at your LinkedIn network, and it basically make some using I don't know what technology, but it makes some guesses about who in your network is worth a little bit more effort from your part. Who should you be reaching out to? That's a second degree connection, perhaps. It just helps you kind of organize that large set of people you know.
How does it do that?
You know, I don't know how the technology works. I just know when once you link your LinkedIn account to it, it makes some very interesting suggestions about where you should be networking into.
Okay, so kind of an algorithm type of sifting process.
Mm-hmm.
LinkedIn, as we've been talking about, has its own app. It's great for news. Features worth noting, let's see, is the new contact management system. Now, is that like broadly?
It's a little bit different. So one of the largest complaints about LinkedIn in the past has been it's very difficult to actually manage all of those contacts. Sure, they're in your network, but what if you want to take notes? Or what if you want to set a reminder for yourself to follow up with that person in a couple of weeks? Well, the new contacts feature in LinkedIn allows you to do that. And it syncs very nicely with the contacts on your phone. And so when you meet somebody and you add them to your network, you can right from your phone schedule a reminder or take notes of how you met that person. And I found it to be probably the largest leap that LinkedIn has made in the last year.
Let's take a couple quick questions. Doug in Columbus, you're on the air with Joshua Waldman. Welcome, Doug.
Hi, how are you doing, Ann?
Fine, thank you.
I just had a quick question relative to the whole concept of the anonymous user. When the great benefits of LinkedIn is kind of get a sense of who's viewing your profile and if it's somebody you've met recently or a potential employer. But, you pay the premium amounts in order to have that, the advanced features, and then, you get several anonymous users, and it's just sort of a head scratcher as to why they allow that. I just wondered if your caller or your gentleman that you're interviewing had any thoughts on that.
Joshua Waldman?
Yeah, Doug, it's a really great feature, actually. If you know who's been viewing your profile, for example, if you're trying to network into a particular location or industry and you're seeing recruiters from that location or industry checking you out, you know you're doing something right. So number one, it's an indicator that you're networking into the right areas, you have the right keywords on your profile. But also, they know that you can see that they view their profile. It's very transparent. And so it's actually, number two, an opportunity to reach out to those people and to say something like, I noticed that you were checking my profile out, and it seems like we have a lot of interest in common. Would you mind if we connected, or how would you like to set up a 15-minute call to see if I can be of service to you? And you're actually making the recruiter's job easier when you do that. So as a job seeker, it's a great tool to really build those relationships with recruiters rather than just putting them blindly on your network. Now, the reason why LinkedIn has these anonymous things, someone anonymously looked at your profile, is there's two reasons for that. Number one, that person has opted out of this feature voluntarily, which means they can't see who saw their profile. And so you can't see that they viewed yours.
Oh.
Okay, so it's a quid pro quo there. The other reason why you're getting that is that LinkedIn wants you to pay for LinkedIn. And so they're only going to give you a couple of names of people who have seen your profile, and the rest are anonymous until you pay. So, of course, there's an upsell reason for that.
Okay, so it's just something you have to buy, no matter what. But if the other person hasn't bought it, it won't matter what you pay. They're still going to be anonymous.
Not necessarily. They have to opt out for them to be anonymous.
I see. Okay. All right, Doug, thanks for that call. Beth, you're on the air and from Columbus. You want to talk about LinkedIn as well. Hello.
Hi, Ann. Let me take you off speakerphone. Hi, Josh. I've been getting your newsletters, and I really appreciate them. They're quite helpful and things that I hadn't thought about. But I have a question for you, and I even learned a couple things in your discussion with Ann that I hadn't thought about. How do I keep up with all the? keeping up with all this stuff, because I'm also running a microblog, and then I'm reformatting my resume, and I have a creative contacts in the past for a creative staffing agency that's really branched out over the years. I don't know if they bought everybody out, but they're all like, well, where's your resume? And I've got my writing samples. I'm working on my resume, and then I belong to like 80 bazillion groups. It's just really hard to keep up. So do you have any suggestions for time management with your social media, especially on LinkedIn? Because the recruiters at this agency said they don't even, you know, I liked their page on Facebook, but the recruiters said they just go to LinkedIn. So,
yeah, recruiters definitely go to LinkedIn.
Okay, I'll take it off the air.
Okay.
I'm listening to what you have to say.
Thanks, Beth.
Okay.
Thanks so much for your question. Yeah, and thank you for reading my blog. Now, recruiters have a time management issue too, and that's why they go to LinkedIn and just default, and that's sort of the thing that they do. And so I'm a huge advocate of checklists. I think that when you have a checklist, particularly with social media, where these networks are engineered to keep you on as long as possible, that's not always in your best interest. So if you have a checklist on LinkedIn, let's say, for example, number one, post a status update. Number two, comment on someone else's status update. Number three, make any minor tweaks to your profile. Number four, check out your groups. And you just go down the list, and probably you can finish up your use of LinkedIn within 15 to 20 minutes a day, which is, relatively speaking, not a whole lot of time. And if you can build checklists for all of the other things that you do, so if you have a microblog and maybe you have Twitter or Tumblr, maybe you're on Facebook as well, you can create checklists of the most valued activities that you do for each of these networks and time yourself. I do. I put a half-hour timer on for my social media use in the morning, and I go through my checklist, and it's very effective, and it frees up a lot of time that otherwise I think would just be sunk checking out links and, you know, people and things like that.
The cute kitten videos. We know what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about.
We have an email from a listener real quick, asks, how do I job search in social media without tipping off my current employer?
There is a feature on LinkedIn. So right now, if you're using LinkedIn and making any changes, the default setting is that, every change you make gets broadcast to your entire network. Now, whether or not they see that, I don't know, but your current boss might be seeing that as an indication of unrest. You can actually turn that notification off. And so you go to your preferences and settings, and you just turn that notifications off, so that when you're updating your headline and putting in a nicer picture and following some of the advice out there on how to spruce up your online presence, you're not tipping off your boss. Just having a LinkedIn profile does not necessarily mean that you're looking for a job. So remember that it's okay to have the profile. You just don't want to give the telltale signs that you're out there.
Okay. Well, Joshua Waldman, author of Job Searching with Social Media for Dummies, now in its second edition. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Ann.
It's Joshua Waldman. We'll continue with Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's like crack just listening to that music. Binge watching new seasons of television series like House of Cards is getting bigger as Netflix has truly revolutionized the way we watch television and movies. This is Tech Tuesday. Welcome back, and I'm Ann Fisher. As we watch late into the night, however, and maybe fall asleep, the show continues on playing without you. For some, not me. For some, that's annoying. Joining us now to talk about it is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Russell, are you guilty of binge-watching anything?
Oh, Netflix has always been a binge-watch thing for me, especially if I'm writing something like a long-term project or something, like when I was working on my book, I would definitely have Netflix just kind of in the corner, almost like background noise, where it was just constantly playing something. I watched like Battlestar Galactica and a couple other TV shows almost entirely that way.
Yeah, I've turned into a binge watcher. I have to admit, it's kind of sad. I did watch House of Cards, the new season, in about 48 hours.
I think Netflix said that like 3% of their entire user base binge watched House of Cards.
I feel terrible about that.
Where they just crushed the entire season that weekend.
And
it took me about a week. So I'm not really that much better.
But. Well, I think if I had younger children, you know, sometimes you have to turn it off. You know, they just can't.
Right.
You know, it's, that's House of Cards for you.
Yeah, especially this season. You can't.
Oh, man, that's right. It gets dicey. There's no spoilers. Netflix, all right. The way it works is you're watching an episode on Netflix, and then as that episode goes off, a little box pops up that says in 18 seconds, the next episode will begin. I mean, they got it down to seconds, and it does it automatically. And for some people, you can wake up the next morning and realize you missed the entire series. I say, so what? Go back and find out where you got lost and start over again. But some people at Netflix did get together to see if they could find a solution to this apparent problem for some. What did they come up with?
Well, so it's not a solution that they're ready to, you know, like call a product yet. It was during a internal hackathon that they did, where a bunch of Netflix developers got together and just came up with cool projects, really more for themselves than for anything else. But it's something that I after looking at, I realized was something that, now that there are so many people binge watching, it may actually be a feature that somebody else, maybe not Netflix, but a third party, rolls out as a real thing. And the idea was using a fitness tracker like Fitbit or something like that, whose job is to stay attached to your body and do things like monitor your sleep and you know, just be aware of your kind of physical well-being. And when the device realizes that you have fallen asleep, to reach out to Netflix and, in this case, slowly bring whatever you're watching to a close. So the example that was given during the demonstration was that once the Fitbit realized you were asleep, it started incrementally decreasing the volume of the television. And then once it reached, you know, maybe 10 minutes where it had been slowly tuning down the volume, it actually stopped the program. And then when you woke up the next morning or the next afternoon, you know, I'm not judging, you could choose between starting the episode where the Fitbit decided to pause things or going back to, you know, just starting the next episode. Like it gave you that readout where you could choose between one or the other. And I thought that was neat. I don't think I've ever actually fallen asleep watching something on Netflix, but I definitely, my wife has. So I could see this being useful to some people if they've already got the technology laying around.
What do you see going into the future as far as the ways wearable technology interacts with watching videos or other media like this?
I think that it's cool that, you know, if you have something that you're already much in the same way that your smartphone, you know, we're starting to use applications that are based on the knowledge that your phone is on you at all times. So, you know, like you've got location applications that will, you know, that will provide services based on the knowledge that your phone is near you. And so it becomes useful that way. So we're looking at the same kind of, you know, application of context where, you know, the application knows that you've got this fitness technology on you. It's got this monitor on you, and it just uses that in coordination with the information that you're already looking at. To give you a better idea of what's going on. And I think that has the potential to be really exciting.
Let's talk about the new Samsung Chromebooks. Samsung is releasing two new Chromebooks this spring. Before we get into the specifics, remind us what a Chromebook is. What's the difference between a Chromebook and everything else?
So it's a laptop, traditionally a very light, very thin laptop, not like MacBook Air thin, but, you know, kind of inexpensive machines, and instead of running Apple's OS X or Windows 8.1 or Windows 8 or even a derivative of Linux, this feels like it is just the browser, and it's running an operating system called Chrome OS, which is a Linux derivative that has the Chrome browser on top of it as kind of your default user interface.
Okay, so you wrote that Samsung is the first commercial Chromebook partner. What does that mean, and why have they done? What have they done with that partnership?
Samsung has been working with Google for a while on their Chrome line. When Google first announced commercial Chromebooks, Chromebooks for schools and Chromebooks for businesses and things like that, Samsung and Acer were both the first two companies that Google worked with to release laptops running Chrome OS. And then Samsung worked with Google to release what they called the Chromebox, which was a desktop replacement that allowed you to connect, you know, multiple monitors and a keyboard and stuff to something that was running Chrome OS. So Samsung has been a part of the Chrome OS ecosystem from the beginning. And they've repeatedly, you know, kind of taken the next step. And then a lot of the other manufacturers have kind of fallen in line behind them and released things that are sometimes a little better and are sometimes a little less expensive. But Samsung has repeatedly been the first one with Google in this particular arena.
We're talking about the Chrome, the new Samsung Chromebooks with Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. But if you have a question or comment for Russell about anything tech-related, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, and we'll try to fit your questions in. So the Chrome operating system is known to be sort of lightweight and smooth, but these new books are coming with a lot of software. Some call it bloatware. What does that mean?
Well, so when you think about a Windows laptop, like when you buy a Windows laptop, it comes preloaded with a lot of extra crud that you maybe never use and you maybe delete right away. Sometimes it's antivirus software. Sometimes it's, you know, an application hub that has a bunch of tools that you're probably never going to use. I think the most egregious violator of that particular mindset right now is Toshiba, where you buy a Toshiba laptop and it just comes with so much extra stuff that nobody ever really uses. But Samsung is the first of the Chrome OS launch partners to release a Chromebook. It's their new Chromebook 2 line that's going to come with premium software. So like software that you would normally have to pay either a subscription for or pay for the higher end version of three different applications that are going to be coming with those laptops.
So tell us more about the two models and the two price points.
So you get two different sizes, basically, and the smaller one is a little less performant than the larger one. There's an 11.6-inch Chromebook 2, which is a very small laptop. It's smaller than most, even like Ultrabooks that you'll find. The screen is a little on the small side. And then the 13.3-inch Chromebook, there's only $80 in price difference between them. The 11-inch version is $319, and the 13-inch version is $399. But really, the benefit that you get with the more expensive model is a 1080p display and a faster processor than the 11.6-inch version. Both of them are running Samsung's processor instead of Intel's. So it's running what's called an Exynos 5 processor instead of what you would normally see, which is something made from Intel.
Let's take a quick call from Mark and Bexley. You're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I have a quick question. I have two 42-inch flat-screen TVs in our house. We have Wi-Fi also, and it's a subscription to Netflix. And we have a Blu-ray device and also one other device, but we cannot seem to get Netflix on our television. So I think we need some additional hardware to be able to view Netflix on our TVs, and what do we need to add? These are not smart TVs.
I know the answer.
Well, let's see if you know the answer. Go ahead.
Roku.
Roku is definitely one of them.
Okay.
There's two different options that you can go with. The first is a little tiny box, you know, no bigger than a phone that plugs into the back of the television called Roku, spelled R-O-K-U. And the other is Google's Chromecast, which is a small HDMI stick that plugs into the back of the television. Both of them are inexpensive. The Chromecast is only $30. The Roku, most of them are around $100. And they will both give you Netflix support. What you get from the Chromecast is the ability to control the entire Netflix experience from your phone or tablet, whereas right. The Roku comes with a remote control that you would use to control it separately.
And it'll both work for my Panasonic 42-inch flat screens?
They will both work with anything that has an HDMI port.
Oh, beautiful. Roku. R-U-K-U?
R-O-K-U.
R-O-K-U. They're in every electronics store.
Wonderful. Thank you for your help.
Yep, you're welcome, Mark.
Thanks.
All right, back to the Chromebooks. What type of software is included with the new Chromebooks? You talked about stuff where they're over Did you tell us what they will come with?
No, so it comes with really three different pieces of software where it's, you know, kind of the premium version. You know, one is the education software. It's Little Bridge. It's a subscription to littlebridge.com, which is an English as a second language tool. It basically teaches you English, and it has a lot of interactive stuff. It's geared primarily towards kids, which is, you know, Chromebooks have a pretty heavy education focus, so it wasn't totally surprising to see that. But the laptops also come with an app called AirDroid, which is specifically for Android phones, that allows you to control the phone from the laptop. So basically gives you control over the dialer, and if you receive text messages and if you get emails and things like that, it all comes through this special web interface that gives you control, so you don't have to reach down and grab your phone when you get a text message or phone call or something like that. And the other, the third app is Wunderlist Pro. Wunderlist is started out as a very simple to-do list and has grown into a really interactive kind of task manager and tool, you know, collaboration suite for businesses. So you can have multiple people working, you know, as kind of a project management tool. It's a really neat app. I've only ever used the free version of the app. I've never had a reason to upgrade to the pro version, but it would come with the pro version if you were to buy one of the Chromebooks.
Dave in Grove City, you're on the air with Russell Holly. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Hey, Russell, I have a question for you about mylife.com. I've got some emails that came from them saying your profile needs updating or someone's searching for you, but these all sound kind of shady to me. And I was wondering if you know anything about these people.
I am not familiar with mylife.com. I've got it right in front of me right now. And it seems like what happened there is you've got maybe one or two friends from Facebook or from LinkedIn or something that have added you as a friend or have picked up your email address from their address book. And is now using that to try and get you to join the service.
Well, okay. Yeah, I know they had a lawsuit against them a few years ago for doing just that sort of thing. So I just wondered if you had ever heard of them or their reputation. Well, thanks very much.
I haven't heard of this service in particular, but yeah, it's relatively common, unfortunately.
We have about a minute to go over the fact that in just over a month, Microsoft will finally stop providing updates for Windows XP. Will this be doomsday for some people?
I hope not. Really, just stop using Windows XP. It doesn't really matter who you are. Just stop it.
And
really using Windows XP. I mean, so there's nothing functionally wrong with Windows XP. The problem is that it's going to stop getting support from Microsoft, which means it's going to become an even greater target than it already is. For things like phishing attacks and viruses. And once a massive exploit happens after that support point, you're not going to get any help from Microsoft in fixing it. So it's just going to become a giant problem. And this really is something that, for the most part, only affects large businesses where, you know, they've got Windows XP on every single computer and, the IT manager is managing 250 or 500 machines all running Windows XP. But, you know, if you're an individual user and you're still running Windows XP on a machine, even if you only use it once a month, even if you only connect to it because it's got your spreadsheets on it for, your internal, financial use, just stop using it. Export everything as quickly as possible and move on with your life.
Get a life. Get rid of Windows XP. Russell Holly, thanks so much for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me.
As usual. Russell Holly, he's tech blogger for geek.com. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.